All right. My name is Charles Boylan. We're here at Discussion at CFRO 102.7 FM. And we've got a truckload of people in here tonight to talk about the problems of salmon farm fishing and the problems it poses to the wild fishery. And we have Alexandra Morton, who is a scientist in this field, and she's on our telephone line. Good evening, Alexandra. Are you there?
Good evening.
Yes, good. Good to hear your voice. Okay, and then in the studio we have Chief Bill Cranmer, and good evening to you, Bill.
Good evening.
And so we're going to have to get all your mics up here, and we've got also Chief. We have Chief Bob Chamberlain on the next mic.
Good evening.
Yes, and then on my immediate left we've got Catherine Stewart from Living Ocean Society. Catherine, good evening.
Good evening, thanks for having us.
Okay, and then the man who's organized this whole gang in here is Peter Dimitrov. Peter, good morning. Good evening.
Good evening, Charles, and good evening, Co-op Radio listeners.
All right, so Peter, I'm going to let you introduce the subject through Alexandra, the problem of fish farming and the hazard it places to the wild salmon fishery, British Columbia.
Good evening, Alexandra. It's a pleasure to have you on our show tonight. And I wonder if you could help us to inform the listeners, if you will, the context of the situation respecting fish farms in the Brighton Archipelago and up north as well, and vis-a-vis the wild salmon that hatch in the streams and rivers and proceed downstream to the ocean, etc. Just outline what your scientific work is, the context, and your concerns.
Yeah, okay, that's quite a bit there, but I'll try to keep it short because the problem really is very simple. In the wild, in the natural world, the wild salmon come back to the rivers, and the majority of them have sea lice. They're a benign little crustacean that lives on the salmon. And when the adult salmon go into the rivers, the sea lice die and the salmon die. So all winter long, the coast washes clean, and by spring, the young salmon come out, and two of the species, the pink and the chum, don't even grow scales before they enter salt water. So they're very, very susceptible and fragile. And so for them, this worked out fine because in the real world, there was no sea lice. But today, we have fish farms placed one after the next along these migration routes. So when the adult salmon come in the fall, they infect the farm fish. The wild fish go into the rivers and die. But the sea lice that get onto the farm fish produce all winter. And a lot of the farms have bright lights on them. This stimulates further lice reproduction. And so by spring, each individual farm can be producing billions of larval lice just as these young wild salmon are going to pass the farms. So it's basically a fatal collision between the parasite and the host that little guys just aren't ready for it. So I've been watching fish farms develop in my area since 1987. At first I thought they were a good idea, and then they began to look like a little bit less of a good idea. The whales I was studying vanished, and there was epidemics that would occur in the farms and then occur in our little enhancement hatchery. And there were toxic algae blooms, there was lots of gunfire, the shot seals. And so with each of those issues, I was writing to government, trying to lay out the problem, thinking, silly me, that they would say, oh, that looks serious, and would look into it and come back to me and go, thank you very much, here's what we're going to do about it. But instead, they were always avoiding the issue. And so when a neighbor brought me a couple of little salmon covered in what we thought were sea lice, they looked very different because they were just really young sea lice. When he brought me these fish, I knew there was nobody to tell. There was nobody to report this to that was going to do anything about it. So I emailed some researchers in Norway who I knew had studied sea lice and basically asked them for the recipe as to how to do this. And they were very patient for me. They were very funny. The first thing they said to me was, do you have fish farms? And so methodically, myself and then a growing number of really spectacular co-authors have joined me and have done their own studies now. And we've answered all the questions. Where are the lice coming from? They're coming from the farms. Do they occur in areas without the farms? No. what happens when you take the farms away? The lice go away and the fish come back. And most recently, on December 14th, I was junior author on a paper that was published in Science. Now, Science is arguably one of the two top journals, scientific journals in the world, and our findings used a lot of DFO data, a lot of our own data, and it said that we have 4 more years in the Broughton Archipelago of wild pink salmon returns, and that it's due to lice, not commercial fishing, not anything that's happening in the rivers. And we did this by looking at a lot of rivers and a lot of different areas, so areas with commercial fishing, areas without commercial fishing. Now, I wouldn't be quite as certain about all of this if this was only occurring in British Columbia, but it's occurring in Europe, throughout Norway, Scotland, Ireland, Iceland, and eastern Canada. It's occurring everywhere that there's fish farms. So it's a very serious problem. I just have finished a paper up, and there was some findings published on it today in the Vancouver Sun about what's happening to all the fish that come out of the Fraser River and the East Vancouver Island rivers and Butte Inlet and the other inlets. What happens to them when they go by all the fish farms off Campbell River? And what we found is there's a lot of lice there, too. So this is really getting serious, because the sockeye that I started my study on off Campbell River, that's exactly the cohort that went missing this fall that closed down the entire South Coast fisheries. Now, I don't know that sea lice are the only thing that wiped them out, but I do know that when you infect your pink and chum salmon with sea lice, they die. I've done a lot of work on that. So there's no reason to believe that the sockeye would go through this without dying unscathed. But the solution is really simple. You just got to separate the wild fish from the farm fish. It's like any feedlot. You know, today nobody would allow wild birds to land in chicken farms or duck farms because of the spread of avian flu. So this problem with the salmon isn't affecting human health, but it's the same dynamic. The wild things pick it up, they carry it all over the place. There's salmon that come from Washington State that go through the Broughton Archipelago. And it's not just sea lice. There's viruses and bacteria also running wild on these farms.
Dan, if I could ask a question, approximately how many farms are there in the Broughton?
There's about 25.
There's some that are of more concern than others near what particular rivers or creeks?
Yes, the ones that are in long, narrow channels near the rivers, they're the worst ones because the lice can't go anywhere. So they just slosh back and forth in there, and they're very, very good at finding fish. So you pour a bunch of young, tender salmon into these channels full of lice, and they just don't make it out the other end.
And when do these young, tender salmon get poured into the ocean?
Well, it depends on our winters, and I would say this winter, probably the middle of March it'll start, and then it peaks in the middle of April.
So can I infer, therefore, it's extremely important to get those farm salmons out of the ocean during this migration period from river, stream to ocean period. Is that correct?
That's correct. They absolutely don't belong there. If you want your wild salmon, they don't belong there. And a lot of people, including the people in your studio there, have worked very, very hard at this year after year, and yet we have more farms on this route than ever before. So the fish farmers just, you know, they're just looking at their bottom line, and wild salmon are their competition, so, you know, they don't really have a huge vested interest in protecting them. But the government really needs to step in here and do something about it, because there are solutions. We could farm and have wild fish.
Alexander, just one question before I go over to Chiefs Bill Kramer and our other guest here to talk to them about it. And that is this, from a capital-centered point of view of the world, they're going to talk about loss of investments. Is there a way to take these fish farms relatively inexpensively and put them on land and separate them completely from the sea?
No, I don't think they could do it inexpensively, because right now they're getting free services from the ocean, so the flushing and the loss of lice, they don't have to deal with that. They're actually farming the wrong animal. The salmon's a high-end carnivore. They should be farming a slow vegetable-eating fish if they really want to make food.
All right. Now I'm going to pass the mics over to Chiefs Cranmer and Oh, dear. Bob Chamberlain. Sorry, Bob. I got your name down the list here far away. But why don't you try and go first, Bill, and then, Bob, you follow right after. Just anything you want to supplement from the point of view of the indigenous people who's been living up there for 1,000 years, fishing wild salmon and making a pretty powerful culture and civilization about it. How do you look at the situation now?
Thank you. The the Numbris, of course, have been able to live very well on the wild salmon, especially in the Nimkish River. And we've been out to watch Alexandra and her team testing the smolts as they're swimming out. And so we know what she's saying is true. We've noticed a decline in the pink salmon, chum salmon. And this year is the first time that there was not one chum salmon returned to the Nimkish River. Not one. And so we lay the blame right on the fish farms. And this is a disaster happening right in front of our eyes. And both governments keep denying that this is happening. And I think what they're doing, because they know the experience in Europe, what they're doing is bordering on criminal.
All right. And Bob, do you want to make a comment on that?
I'd agree with Chief Cramner's statements about this actions or non-actions at both levels of governments being criminal. You look around the world, be it Chile, Iceland, Norway, Scotland, Ireland, and every one of these places, they have outward migrating salmon and trout as well, and they know beyond any other doubt of proof that this sea lice is prevalent within the open net cage fish farms.
And within the context of collapses of world fisheries, including the codfish off the East Coast and now the collapse of fish in the North Sea and so on, you would think that they would have a somewhat more circumspect view about the need to keep the salmon running here.
I'm surprised with the provincial government's focus and understanding of tourism as a large economic engine in the province of B.C., and a good portion of that would be around catching salmon or being around the animals that rely upon the wild salmon. You got places like Iceland at 90% of their coastline outlaws having open net cage fish farms. That's because they put a high value on the wild salmon that is found in Iceland, and they also know the economic potential that represents for people coming from around the world, as they used to do here in BC, and they would come and they pay good money to go fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the salmon, both Bill and Bob, is a very important part of the, I would call it the Indian economy, the renewable resource economy for your peoples, going back, as Charles said, since time immemorial. What kind of cultural significance does it have for your people?
Well, salmon, of course, is a major part of our diet.
Mm-hmm.
And our people, for years and years, have been depending on the not only the sockeye in the Nimkish River, but the chum salmon. Our people smoked the chum salmon to carry us over through the winter. And again, this year, we had not one chum salmon return. And I'm just wondering if the Premier and his government want this to be their legacy, the destruction of the wild salmon. I don't think so.
I would imagine you've got various, I would call it, indigenous laws in place that govern how your peoples, both the Namgis and the Gibson Island people, manage your own fish. Is that correct?
We do.
Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, we do. And for years, the Numbris have been enhancing the salmon in the Nimkish River. We run our own hatchery. The old people, they had their own way of managing the salmon. And, you know, we've heard our old people talking about harvesting hundreds and hundreds of salmon to preserve, to carry them through the winter,
mm-hmm.
and also to trade. So it's very, very important to our people that the salmon is not destroyed. Salmon doesn't go extinct.
To either Bob or yourself, Bill, are there, you know, stories and songs and legends and dances that are important to your people involving the salmon?
Certainly there is. Our people have the salmon dance, and the way I understand it is to pay respect to the significance of what this food source means to our people. The honor of dancing is bestowed upon twins within the family, and it's a way for us to recognize the specialness of twins, and I think that's worldwide, you know, if we're fortunate enough to have twins in our family. But we bestow upon them the rights to dance the salmon dance, and it's a way to link that specialness.
So when you say then that this is the non-actions of the federal government and the actions of the provincial government in allowing fish farms to continue with this evidence that was published in Science magazine, with which Alexandra Morton just alluded to, that it borders on the criminal, this is a very serious indeed allegation, but there is some truth to what you're saying.
No, there's plenty of truth in the words you're hearing tonight. I participated with the Simon Fraser University at a dialogue for salmon not too long ago, and I got to listen yet again to the rhetoric that comes from DFO and the rhetoric that comes from Ministry of Agriculture and Lands. And then my discussions with the scientists from around the world, in particular the one from Ireland, he said he's heard all this before. Deny, deny, delay, deny, and, you know, instill some sort of doubt about science that comes along. And so what we're seeing is a pattern that's played itself out around the world. I mean, the impacts are well documented worldwide. You know, Gordon Campbell and the Liberal government seem to be negligent in embracing the science that's known everywhere else.
What do you think of this, Alexandra?
Bob's absolutely right. There's a tremendous scientific consensus. There's been extraordinary alliances built between scientists just to answer these questions because we feel it is so urgent. And as we deny and delay, we have fewer and fewer salmon. Salmon, along with their tail and their fin, they require diversity to survive, particularly to survive a changing planet. And every year we're knocking that back further and further and crippling these fish. And our future generations are going to be so furious with us. They're not going to believe we squandered something as valuable as wild salmon.
Catherine, can I get you to add your voice into this discussion a little bit? You're from Living Oceans. I made the comment a little bit earlier that this destruction of the wild salmon seems to be in sync with the overall assault on the oceans generally, and I'm wondering if you could add a comment about that.
Absolutely. I mean, the study that was published recently by Boris Wurm and other scientists predicting the complete crash of our wild ocean fish populations within 40 years if action isn't taken is indicative, I think, of the negligence on both the part of our federal and provincial governments in managing our fisheries for the future. They allowed the cod stocks to crash. They are burying their heads in the sand around a tremendous global weight of scientific evidence about the impacts of fish farms. And I think that we also have to keep in mind that when we talk about the salmon, we're not only talking about commercial and recreational fisheries, we're not only talking about the backbone of many coastal indigenous cultures, we're also talking about the lifeblood of this coast. You know, we run these ads about supernatural BC. What do we think the orcas eat? What do we think the eagles eat? Even the riparian forests, the old growth forests, derive 70% plus of their nutrients from the carcasses of wild salmon. So we are risking ecosystem collapse when we allow this to happen to our salmon.
You know, I have to put it to, I'm going to put it to everybody here. This is a political question because we're talking about government policy. We're talking about a response to human society, to Mother Nature, and we're talking about corporate response to the rest of the citizenry, to the polity. And it would seem that the whole global agenda, you know, that what do they call it, globalization, the whole corporate agenda is driving us to a very real threat to our species as well as to the whole natural species. Politically, this puts an enormous pressure on all of us how to affirm ourselves in power and actually have control over these key questions. So have you given thought, or what thoughts have you given to how do the citizens of British Columbia actually control their own government and make decisions that are rational and protective of Mother Earth and our own species' future? So let's start with our telephone guests, and I'm going to go right around the room, Bill and Bob and on and on. So first over to the telephones.
Alexandra.
Yes, I think it's extremely important that everybody make sure that they're heard on this issue, and I'm devoting a lot of time right now to just gathering up all these voices and trying to point them in a direction that they can be heard. And And really, I think it's Gordon Campbell that needs to hear from us on this. And I think also that something has to be done in the courts, because I've tried to deal with this problem. Catherine's tried to deal with this problem. Bob and Bill have also tried for, you know, almost 20 years now, and they're just not listening to us, and there's not going to be anything left. So I'd say everybody out there, make sure you're heard.
When I like to ask Catherine a question here. I know that you've been involved with Living Ocean Society for quite a while, and if you could tell us a little bit about the history of the process that you've been involved with, and the Canadian and BC provincial positions, and your market campaign, things like that.
And also bear in mind the question, I mean, what do we do, you know?
Do we do?
Sure. Well, I do want to hear from Bill and Bob as well about what citizens can do. Personally, to address your question, Charles, I think that it has been illustrated that the government will listen if their feet are held to the fire enough. And a good example of that was the Coquihalla Highway debate. When the citizens rose up in anger and just fought back, you know, they forced the government to back down. And I think part of our problem here in Canada is we're just too passive. If you see, you know, other citizenry around the world, when subsidies are being cut to farmers in France, They're marching in the streets, in the millions. They're saying, no, we will not accept this from our government. Whereas here, we have a tendency to be very polite and go, oh, well, you know, that's really unfortunate, and we're sorry to see that happen. Not enough. Not when the entire health of our coastal ecosystem is on the line. There's a lot of challenges facing us around the world right now, both economic challenges and issues like homelessness and poverty and climate change. There's a lot of issues. And one of the things that the government always says is, well, you know, you don't know that it's the sea lice that are causing the decline in salmon, because it could be climate change, and it could be land-based sources of pollution, and, you know, it could be habitat loss. Well, all of those things are undoubtedly factors, but we have to ask, what can we fix now? How can we start to relieve the pressure on these fish by fixing the things that are within our power to fix in very short order? Climate change is going to take us a while. Getting the farms out of the migratory route of the wild salmon, we could do that right away if the will was there. So speak up and let both the federal and provincial governments know that you demand that change. And just
yeah, Bob and Bill, maybe go first, and then Bob, tune in. I mean, we're looking at 150 years of colonial history here, and I mean, Mother Nature has taken a swack as a result of it, and now it's right putting the lifeline of the coast in jeopardy. And I have to say, as a settler, you know, who came here in innocence, not knowing the story, salmon has become part of my culture. I've grown up on salmon, I've grown up on seafood, and I think that's true for a whole lot of British Columbians who are, especially on the West Coast here. And so it's part and parcel of our outlook on life and way of life as well. So we've got lots in common here. What to do?
I think people are doing that now with the tourism operators, not only in the Alert Bay area, Broughton Archipelago area, but because with no wild salmon, you're not going to have a sports fishery, you're not going to have a bear watching industry, and everything that's connected to the wild salmon will be gone. And what's going to attract people to come to British Columbia for in the tourism industry? They're not going to. What can we do? If we had the money right now, we'd be in court. We'd be in court. But it costs so much money to file a writ to deal with this.
And it's very protracted.
I've reviewed the case law just the last couple of days respecting First Nations people going to court on this issue, and on several occasions they've tried to obtain injunctions. I believe one time there was, I think in 2005, a temporary injunction granted to a specific nation, and they did not get a permanent injunction respecting the fish farms. It's extremely difficult to win, but I think when you consider the actions of the fish farms and how it affects your economy and your culture and the rights of future generations of young First Nations people, this is bordering on genocide, what we're talking about. When the buffalo disappeared from the plains, that wiped out the Plains Indian economy and wiped out their culture, their language, etc. And I was looking at the International Criminal Court today and what exactly constitutes genocide. And I think when you destroy a people's means of production to support themselves, that is indeed within some of the some of the articles that define what genocide means. And I would say to you that there may be some remedies there, because we certainly don't have any in Canada at this point in time.
Bob, you want to speak to that?
I believe this industry is all politics. I mean, when the government steps up and denies the valuable science and all the hard work and what's known globally, what else can it be? I think that the extinction that we're facing on various components of the coast in terms of our wild salmon, this cuts through individuals' belief of supporting First Nations or not supporting First Nations. This is about wild salmon. You know, I hope that everyone that's ever taken a rod out and gone out and caught a salmon and enjoyed those moments with their father, their grandfather, their uncle, or whoever it may be, those are the people that need to rise up. They're the people that need to express their voice very clearly. We as a First Nation, you know, we in the media you hear quite often that Gordon Campbell and the Liberal government talk of the new relationship and the recognition of Aboriginal rights and title and the development of new mechanisms for shared resource decision-making in our territory. I'm a leader of our First Nation of Guilford Island, the Kwikwesotinukwaqmi's people, and I can tell you there is no new relationship. It's a name brand. Any kind of agreement now with a First Nation, they've slapped the new relationship title to it. But if you go back and review, in particular, Goals 2 and 3 of the new relationship document, and you ask a First Nation anywhere in the province of BC, do they enjoy what's being promised and foretold in the new relationship? And they'll tell you the same thing that I'm telling you tonight. There is no new relationship.
Catherine.
Thanks. I just wanted to make one further comment on the solution question. Right now, the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform has a budget submission into the province asking for a $10 million allocation in the 2008 budget to get serious about closed containment, to get pilot projects up and running with matching funds from entrepreneurs to prove that this technology can work in BC, because it can work. And we constantly hear the industry say, well, it's too expensive. Alexander referred to this earlier. Sure, it's going to be more expensive, because right now they're getting a free ride. They're dumping their waste into our oceans. They're allowed to let their fish escape. They're allowed to let diseases and parasites transfer to our wild fish. And it's very comfortable for the Norwegian corporations who own 90% of the fish farms in British Columbia. They like to portray themselves as a local employer. These are multinational corporations based in Norway, operating in Canada, operating in Chile, operating around the world, and the profits are not staying here. And the jobs are exaggerated. The industry likes to claim there's like 6,000 jobs or 3,500, 4,000 jobs. We always hear these numbers. The most recent study that was done for the Special Legislative Committee on Sustainable Aquaculture came up with a total of 2,900, and that includes direct, indirect, and induced jobs. So it's a small industry having a huge impact with the profits, 90% of the profits flowing back to Norwegian shareholders. And so I would ask people, if you want to get active, one thing you can do is call your MLA and say you want to see that $10 million in this budget and you want to see the government start to act. Enough talk, time for action.
I have a very dark premonition about a lot of this stuff. I'm going to share my premonition with you guys, and you tell me if I'm just having bad nightmares or there's some possibilities to it. It would seem to me that if you did destroy the wild salmon fishery in BC, there would be no excuse left now not to dam the Fraser for hydropower at Hell's Gate. There would be no reason not to put every wild river into a pipe and turn it into private power development. It would there would be no reason not to channel all that river fresh water and pipe it down to, I know some really thirsty places on this planet. They're not very far away. They're called California and Arizona and Nevada, etc. I mean, are we really looking at something as dark as this? I mean, because, otherwise you can't. I mean, I don't know how you explain a rational reason when all the evidence is before you. you take a fishery that eliminates any kind of individual initiative or community initiative to make a livelihood. You make fish the complete ownership of a corporation so that every human being who wants to buy fish has to buy it from a big multinational company. They can't buy it from the local native Indian fisherman. And I confess to buying salmon. I say that publicly. And I am very happy to be dealing with my local native fisher because traditionally, they've been fishing those fish forever, and that's their job, and they do it really well, and I really like the fish, and the price is right. And I don't have Jimmy Patterson standing in the way, and I don't have these Norwegian fish farm companies trying to sell me poison fish. So can you guys respond to that a little bit?
Alex would love to. she shares your vision.
Alex,
yeah,
go for it.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, because as I've been wading through this in this debate and watching the industry get bigger and trying to come up with a solution and watching my friends work themselves to the bone trying to find solutions, I couldn't figure out why they would risk something as valuable as wild salmon. And I think it does have to do with freshwater and it has to do with oil. If you look at what happened to the cod on the East Coast, you had scientists within the Department of Fisheries and Oceans saying, these cod are going extinct. And they were told to sit down and be quiet. One of them is the late Ransom Myers, who was a fantastic man, and he said he lasted about 2 more minutes, and then he said he quit because he was not going to do that. But the Department of Fisheries and Oceans let those cod go down. They threw fish farms to the coast that's reeling in shock, and as soon as there were no more commercial fishermen, the Hibernia Oil Project went on to the Grand Banks. Now, the Grand Banks once produced more food than probably any one single source on Earth, human-grade food. And I don't think that those oil wells would have gone in if the commercial fishing was still active. So I'm not saying it was a plan, but that is what happened there. That is the sequence of events. And watching here, I have colleagues within the Department of Fisheries and Oceans who I have enormous respect for, but I can tell you they are not speaking their mind on this issue. They can't. And there's many scientists that are retired now from the Pacific Biological Station who are talking to me, and they're saying, you know, I was in this position in the Nechako River debate or various other debates, and I quit. And these people took a major hit in their pensions just because they stood up for what they believed. And, you know, it's a tough thing to do when you're a scientist with a family. So I think you've hit it on the head. This is not about fish. This is about freshwater, about oil, possibly logging. Salmon in a pen just fits so many corporate agendas that is what this is truly about.
Well, all right, so let's go around the table, and I'll ask the chiefs and if you share this, because I'd forgotten, Alexander, thanks for reminding me. Oil and gas, they want to drill Heckett Strait, they want to drill into the Charlottes, they want to, you know, in Charlotte Sound or Charlotte Strait, I can't remember which, Dixon Entrance, goodness knows where, they do want to get in the oil and gas rigs in there. Do you guys feel this is what we're looking at, a bigger agenda here than just happenstance, you know, argument about whether sea lice kill salmon?
It certainly wouldn't surprise me. I think the proof bears itself out on the East Coast, the demise of the cod, the expansion of oil and gas. Gordon Campbell, I believe when he was in China last year, talked about BC and the potential to become a gas provider and on the global market. And with their lack of attention and lack of listening to what's going on with our fish in the wild, and if I want people that are listening to this program tonight to not buy into the rhetoric that the provincial government, in particular Minister Pat Bell from the Ministry of Agriculture and Lands, he'll go on and talk about how this industry is on almost 100% compliant to the most stringent regulations in all of the world. That's garbage. When you want to compare this industry and rules and regulations from places like Chile that really don't have any environmental standards to speak of, and ours is, we don't have any kind of First Nation definition or First Nation involvement in development of these terms of sustainability. And again, I'll point back to that new relationship. And the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, I've listened to Minister Loyola Hearn speak about incorporating traditional ecological knowledge into the decision making, very much mirroring what Gordon Campbell speaks of with the new relationship. And it's just not around. You know, I participated with a group of tourism operators in Broughton Archipelago last week and met with Assistant Deputy Minister from the Ministry of Tourism just to relay to him and to that ministry, and remind them that they have a responsibility to look out for the well-being of present-day operators of tourism. And there was a large group of us from the North Island, and I spoke to him about, I was hoping that, or my expectation is that ministry is to look out for potential economic opportunities as it relates to tourism. And I mentioned our First Nations involvement in developing a broader economic development strategy, looking at ecotourism as one of the primary pieces to help our people get out of poverty and to know that it's at risk simply with the loss of salmon.
All right, and Bill, comment?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the buffalo. I attended a meeting in North Vancouver talking about fish farms, and there was a marine biologist that Health Canada used to do environmental assessments on sites that have been left, and fish farms moved to another site. And he could not find anything wrong with the site. There's one site across from Chief Chamberlain's village that I think is still a dead zone that had a fish farm on it. And his parting comment was, well, you can't keep hunting buffalo. And we couldn't believe it. He would say that. And he worked for Health Canada doing environmental studies. But, you know, even the owner of the largest fish farm in the world, Norwegian gentleman, has said that fish farms shouldn't be in the migratory routes of wild salmon. And that's a policy that they're apparently taking in Norway.
But yet it's happening here in British Columbia with Norwegian fish farms.
Right.
All right, Catherine, do you want to add a comment at this point?
Sure. Well, there's so much to say. And, you know, we are really concerned, of course, about the potential of the broader agenda and what will happen to our natural resources and the health of our coastal ecosystems if the salmon go. Because I do believe you that an awful lot of damage could follow, including oil and gas, dams, etc. But to get to the specifics, too, about fish farms, while the federal and provincial governments here are in denial about the weight of scientific evidence on sea lice, and the companies are insisting that there's no direct causal link and there's no conclusive scientific proof, Bill just mentioned the Norwegian government. The Norwegian government is now ordered that 51 fjords in Norway be cleared of salmon farms close to the river mouths where the wild salmon emerge, that the farms have to move much further out of the fjord. And two of the fjords they've declared as important enough for wild salmon runs that they want all the salmon farms out of there. So obviously the governments in other jurisdictions recognize the weight of evidence. And it reminds me of the climate change debate. You know, George Bush says there isn't climate change. 2,500 scientists from the IPCC, the world's top climate scientists, say that, yes, there is. And 10 guys that are paid by the oil and gas industry say, no, there isn't. And suddenly the deniers are saying there's a scientific debate. And that's exactly where we're at with the issue around the impacts of farms. The proponents of open neck cages are claiming that there's a scientific debate. There's no debate. The global weight of evidence is staggering, and there's a few folks that want to put their heads in the sand and some others that want to, you know, generate some very dubious science, very seldom subject to peer review, that calls into question the conclusions of the vast majority of scientists. And I think that Bill also touched on the regulations in BC, Bob did, and Minister Bell touting the regulations in BC. there was an interesting appearance and disappearance of a report. The Pacific Salmon Forum, which is funded by our tax dollars to the tune of $5 million to supposedly provide unbiased advice on what to do about aquaculture and salmon, had a report on their website that contained an appendix by an author named Gareth Porter, and he looked at sort of BC's performance standard on a whole bunch of different fronts on aquaculture, and in some he was scoring us at 1 out of 10. In others, we were getting 6 out of 10, and the overall average was about 5 out of 10. And when that report first went up, we were quite taken aback by it. A month later, it was gone. It was just pulled off the website. So not only are we dealing with, you know, denial of science, but we're also dealing with rampant suppression of information. DFO claims that they have studies that call the science into question. Where are the studies? They don't publish them. They don't subject them to external peer review. Where's the science?
All right, Peter.
It
seems to me, I like to speak about this from a legal perspective. It seems to me that with respect to authorizing legislation that would that gives fish farms the existence in the Broughton Archipelago and other areas in off the coast of British Columbia, it primarily, it's rubber stamped by the legislature, but it primarily comes from the Premier's office. And I doubt very much, considering our guests here today, both Bill Cranmer and Bob Chamberlain, that First Nations people were, in a sense, meaningfully consulted with respect to that policy. I doubt they were. So it seems to me that what's going on is that the Premier and the Crown are saying to themselves that this water and these fish are Crown assets, and we can legislate about them. We can pass laws about them. But I would say to you that likely you've got evidence, you've got a long evidence of historical records of your using the fish, of using that water, that you could indeed lay claim to those waters and those fish as Aboriginal title. They belong to you, and thereby you could challenge the validity of those laws. So that is indeed one possible solution. The other thing I noticed is an absence of any kind of coastal zone management. To look at the entire coast of British Columbia and put in place some kind of shared mechanism whereby First Nations people and the Crown equally together sit down and do coastal zone planning as to what happens on the rivers, what happens on the ocean foreshore, etc., etc. That's completely non-existent. So there is a need for legal reform, and as you mentioned, Charles, the only people that can challenge this, really, are the people of British Columbia and Canada, who must rise up and indeed tell the BC government and the Department of Fisheries that they have to pull these fish farms, these fish pens, from the ocean, open waters. So I like other people's comments on this.
All right, well, let's go to Bill
and Alexander.
And everybody can go, but Bill, first to you.
Well, it's true. They have a management team on the West Coast that has just recommended that a renewal of a farm not be done because of the low returns to the rivers in that area. And I think Ahauset, the First Nation, is part of that that management team. It's made up of different communities at the West Coast. So we do need that, and obviously the Department of Fisheries and Oceans is incapable of managing this resource, and you know, we haven't mentioned the herring in the Broughton Archipelago and the mainland inlets. There hasn't been a commercial herring fishery for over 20 years.
And then there used to be, that used to be the gold rush. And I can remember when the boats used to sink, they were so overweighted.
Why is that?
And we don't know. We suspect, again, it's the salmon farms. I think there was just a study come out recently that said the small herring are being affected by the sea lice.
Alexander, do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, that was my study. We found sea lice on herring that were so young that the herring are almost transparent. They don't have scales. But worse than that, in 2002 and 2003, there was an epidemic of a virus called IHN, and it transferred from one sockeye into a fish farm in eastern Johnson Straits and then spread through the farms right up to Bella Bella through my area and up off of Port Hardy. And when one of the farms in Chief Chamberlain's territory there was dying, they couldn't get the fish out fast enough, so there was eyeballs and offal rotting through it. And underneath that, I could see the herring that were coming into Kinkam Inlet to spawn. Well, when you challenge herring with IHN, 25% of them die. And when I brought this up to DFO, they said, oh, well, yeah, no, that's true, but that's just in the laboratory. But that's why you do the laboratory study, so you can extrapolate and protect things outside of the laboratory. So the management here is very reckless and careless. There hasn't been a commercial salmon fishing fishery opening in the Broughton since the sea lice epidemics began in 2001. You can't even catch a pink salmon in the main area here anymore. It's the tourism industries here are worth $1.6 billion for wilderness tourism alone, and all of them virtually depend on salmon. It's an act of sheer recklessness, and I don't understand. And one thing people need to keep in mind, farming salmon is called fish farming, but it's actually another form of commercial fishing, because to feed those salmon, they have to catch fish down in the South Pacific. And so they're depleting resources down there, and then you're bringing these fish up and turning them into pellets and putting dye in them and all kinds of things, and then they throw them back in the water, and in the end they take out less fish. So to me, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever, even from a global point of view.
Well, I think it has some sense in terms of not the global point of view, but certainly from corporate profit of a particular company. And I think that's really what the blockage is that we're facing here. We're facing a very small interest in juxtaposition to a huge collective interest, and that's the clash, it seems to me. There's no other rational explanation for it. Somebody's making a lot of money out of it. There may be other interests behind it, like oil and gas and running water out, like we've discussed, Alexander. But surely all of that is tantamount to the whole society having to face a very small, very wealthy, very powerful minority interest facing us all down, and it behooves all of us to find a way to block them before they wipe us all out. That's what I think. Anyhow, yeah.
They're winning just by being big, and they're behaving like bullies. We've all tried to speak to them with great rationality and politeness. I've seen Chief Cramner insulted when he's gone up to these farms to talk to them, and personally, for me, watching these little beautiful little salmon come out of the rivers and go by the farms, and these little lice get on them, and the next thing you know, they're full of holes and they're bleeding. And those little fish, from the moment they leave their mother's body, they're feeding everything around them. They are so generous. And if anybody out there has any ideas as to how I personally could stop this from carrying on, please contact me. Just Google me. You'll find my email address there. And I don't know what to do anymore. It's just so many people have tried something for so long. The river next to me, the Meetup River, Chum River, it's dead. The beautiful little Otta is about to go, probably in about 8 weeks when those fish come out. The Wakeman and the Kinkum are dying. As Chief Cramner mentioned, the Nimkish River fish, I looked at those little guys, too, and they were covered with lice because there was a fish farm packing plant right next door to the river. The Squamish chums that have disappeared, those guys went by fish farms. It's pretty serious, and we don't have a lot of time left to figure this out. And, I'd say to the fish farmers, if you guys want to save your own industry, you better, own up to the lice here and just deal with it and get on with it, because it's really catching up to us.
Anybody else like to join in here, Bill and Bob? Bob, you want to say something?
For the past two springs, I've been fortunate enough to participate with the Pure Salmon campaign and make two trips to Norway, where we invited ourselves to Marine Harvest's AGM for the shareholders. And in that trip, we coordinated quite a bit of meetings with Norwegian government officials, both related to aquaculture and just the environment in general. And we met with the equivalent, the DFO equivalent within the Norwegian government, and the man we met with is one below their minister. And at that meeting, there was himself, there was a lawyer, and there was a marine biologist. And my first question to the marine biologist is, can you confirm to me your understanding and knowledge that open net fish farms contribute, or are the environment to contribute and develop fish, sea lice that impacts outward migrating salmon smolts? And without any hesitation at all, the marine biologist, without even consulting the lawyer in the room, said, of course. And she did everything to hold back her laugh when I told her that the provincial government of British Columbia is still studying this. Mm. And to me, after that and the experience of talking to the top people at Marine Harvest, I came home and I understand now that the fight is with the government of BC and with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. These international companies, they don't really care about us. They don't really care about our environment. They look at the bottom line.
Yeah, right.
And I understood that when we were listening to the shareholders and their discussions. And so when we as a First Nation that here in Canada, I mean, it's only the Supreme Court of Canada that defines that we have Aboriginal rights and Aboriginal title. And it's only the Supreme Court of Canada that says the government is supposed to be, or is obliged to, or has the responsibility to consult and accommodate our interests. And I can tell you it's not happening. We can look in the Broughton Archipelago, which is in the traditional territory of our First Nation. We have a regional collapse in every kind of marine species you can think of, from little necks to butter clams to herring to the ooligan to the salmon. And one of the things I'd like to highlight tonight is the study that we did, and where we identified elevated levels of mercury in whitefish that's caught in and around the fish farms, to the point where Health Canada issued a notice to it to not consume more than one serving a week if you catch it around the fish farms. And to me, I find it absolutely insane when they want to minimize the extinction we're witnessing in our territory. And if you look at DFO numbers, they like to talk about the mainland pink stock theater. And when they say that, they're able to then take the spawning channel returns of Glendale Cove, which is well away from the Broughton Archipelago, and it's quite a ways up Knights Inlet. And that is how they falsely portray the abundance of pink salmon in our territory. If you were to look at those numbers on an annual basis and remove the Glendale Cove numbers, you get a really good idea of what's going on in the Broughton Archipelago.
Well, all right. We're coming up fairly quickly to the top of the hour. And I just, you know, Chief Bill Cramner, I mentioned to you when I saw you come in and asked you, I said, are you related to Dan Cramner? And for our listening audience, we think that the history somehow is over hundreds of years, but it's your father who in 1922 was attacked by a colonial government that was hell-bent on banning the potlatch, outright denying Indigenous people the right to their culture. Materials were stolen. Big fight went on for, 60 years to get the material back. A victory happens in 1980. Your sister opens up with the Umista, brings the gear back. All these wonderful works of art, treasures of the culture of these peoples who've been here forever. And now, after that victory, we're looking at the extinction of the very source of the life that gave rise to that culture. And you're the son of the man. You know, you're just one, it's one generation away. I think there's just a whole lot of energy and effort has to be, you know, infused into the whole rest of the British Columbia population so that this story can, you know, carry the momentum that it ought to carry in terms of fighting for a culture, fighting for a way of life, fighting for a whole wildlife heritage against the greed of a few corporations who want to take the, you know, make fish for sale and fish farms and take the oil and gas. Anyhow, comment, please, if you got one.
Well, yeah, you're right. In 1921, my father held a potlatch, and in 1922, they were arrested people were arrested for being at that potlatch. 26 of them were sent to prison from anywhere from 2 months to 6 months, and part of the agreement was that they would give up their masks and other things they used in the potlatch so that more people wouldn't be sent to prison. And as you say, we managed to repatriate all of those pieces, which is now housed in the Umista Cultural Center in Alert Bay. So it's been a pretty sad history. I have a saying, when Captain Vancouver first came up to our territory in 1792, he saw healthy, industrious people, the Numpis people. And then shortly after that, of course, we all know that 90% of our people died because of the diseases that were brought over from Europe. And then, of course, Indian reserves were put in place, and then the potlatch prohibition followed shortly by the residential school. So it just went from bad to worse. And we've managed to survive this long, and now they're killing something else that has allowed us to survive.
Bill's going to follow in his father's footsteps, and he's going to win his fight.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that, you know, it's been a dark past, but we have now that dark past actually facing your peoples is facing all British Columbians, and I think that's really the point to drive home, and I think everybody in the room here understands that what's attacking you guys, in that sense, is attacking all British Columbians. Now we really have to take a stand together to turn this thing around.
So people can take action, and one of the first things they can do is refuse to buy farm salmon. The other thing they should do anytime they're in a store or restaurant, ask, is it farmed or is it wild? If the store can't tell you or the restaurant won't tell you, don't buy it, and tell them to stop selling farm salmon. And then speak up to your MLA, write letters to the editor, phone the Info BC line, and let your voices be heard so that these cultures and these traditions and the ecosystem of BC can be protected. And if people want more information on this, they can go to our website, which is livingoceans.org, or they can go to the coalition website at farmedanddangerous.org.
All right, and Peter, you want to say one last word?
Yeah, there are other websites too that could be of value. I think Google Save Our Salmon has some very good information on it, and also a petition to be signed. There's a young filmmaker named Twyla Roskovich, and her website is callingfromthecoast.com, who's got a great video out on this particular matter. And I would say, as a kind of a final thing, I think there needs to be a court challenge to challenge the failure of DFO to exercise their lawful jurisdiction to protect the salmon and the salmon habitat, and perhaps to challenge the lack of, to challenge the negligence and perhaps even the abuse of power by the British Columbia government allowing farm salmon to continue with this kind of scientific evidence available.
All right. Well, without competing lawyers against scientists, Alexander, you get a word in, and then going to have a last word from Bob and Bill. Alexander?
I want to read you a quote. This is John Litnam from the Norwegian Parliamentary Committee on Environment from Norway in 1990. He said, "We're very strict about the quality and the environment. Therefore, some of the fish farmers went to Canada. They said, 'We want bigger fish farms. We can do as we like.'" And then he goes on to say, "That is a very hot subject, I think." And he's correct. We knew in the beginning that they came here to get away from the rules in Norway, and that's what they're doing.
All right, Bill and Bob, last word goes to you guys.
Well, if nothing is done about the fallowing of these farms, not only in the Broughton, but the farms between the Broughton and Camel River, I think we're going to have to go to court.
All right, well, and Bob?
What we're facing here in terms of salmon is the equivalent to the pine beetle epidemic up in the interior. And it's time that British Columbians wake up and get involved in voicing their concerns and getting informed past the rhetoric that the province has.
All right, and thank you very much, Alexandra Morton, scientist, Chief Bill Cramner, Chief Bob Chamberlain, and get all this straight, Catherine Stewart, and Peter Dimitrov. Charles Boylan saying good evening. Thanks, guys, for coming in and joining us on discussion. CFRO 102.7 FM is the station you're listening to. Stay tuned to Union Made.